Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 20. Today on the show, we have Hank Kreienhoff, elite sprint coach, researcher, and consultant to some of the world's best coaches and athletes. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. Ladies and gents, welcome to episode 20 of the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in with us today. We have for you Hank Kreienhoff today. Hank is one of the smartest coaches and consultants out there in the world of training and conditioning. Hank has years of experience training many of the fastest sprinters in the world, as well as a variety of athletes in other sports and disciplines, and he works on consulting with many of the smartest coaches and sports federations. I first heard Hank speak at the Central Virginia Sports Performance Seminar. He gave an amazing presentation on speed training, with not only a lot of practical knowledge, but a lot of scientific data and research to back it up. Hank is one of the best guys out there in being able to use the literature towards training the individual athlete and not just making generalizations. In terms of building athlete-centered programs, which is something that the coaching community is definitely trying to work on steering itself towards, Hank is one of the best guys out there to talk to in terms of things like how athlete muscle twitch type determines training, what their psychology does in terms of how to cue them, coach them, how to prepare them for competitions, and as well as a variety of other variables and training means. Hank is just an amazing resource, great guy, and I'm so happy to have him on the show today talking about a variety of points on athletic training. We're going to go into Hank's thoughts on plyometric exercise and its correlation to different phases of a 100-meter sprint, coaching and cueing. We're going to talk about neurotransmitter types, muscle fiber types. We're going to talk about how to assess muscle fiber types in athletes without sticking a shotgun needle in your leg. We're going to talk about things like balancing training data, how much training data is good, how much training data should we use in balance with coaching intuition, training warrior versus warrior type athletes, as well as Hank's new book coming out, What We Need Is Speed. And although a lot of what we talk about here, at least some, is in regards to track and field and 100 meter speed, there is so many applications that can be made for any athlete in any sport where speed is a factor. This is a great conversation, one of the favorite ones I've had, just on the topic of steering training towards the athlete and not just making generalizations. And I know you guys are going to really enjoy it. I definitely love putting it together. So here we go. All right, Hank, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being on here today.
You're welcome.
So first question I have for you is, what is your take on the idea of plyometrics that cater towards different phases of a 100-meter race? So start, acceleration, top end speed, and so on and so forth.
Okay. To keep things simple for today, not discussing the exact definition of plyometrics, we're talking about bounding and jumping most of the time in simple terms. I found a relationship by testing many athletes and looking at the different phases of the race in the 100 meters, between number one, the block start action, and the squat jump. And the squat jump is jumping from a 90 to 100 degree angle, isometrically to concentrically. Well, that's the same thing that you do in the start. You go from isometric contraction to a concentric contraction, at least when if you look at the quads, the activity of the quads. Then I found a strong relationship between acceleration phase and counter movement. Counter movement jump is eccentric, concentric, you stand straight up, you go down and jump as high as you can. A good relationship between the jumping height and the quality of your acceleration. For the maximum speed phase, it was a different test that we used. It was part of the Bosco test. Bosco was one of my main mentors, a brilliant Italian exercise physiologist who wrote many things about explosive strength. Most of the time it's, well, I don't know, ignored and neglected, or it just disappeared, his information, but I think it was groundbreaking information. And for the maximum speed phase, we use the reactivity test. I mean, you stand on the jump mat, jump 5 seconds with almost extended knee with stiff knees, the shortest possible contact time and the highest jump possible jump height. So you can jump higher, but then the contact time will be longer. You can jump a very short contact time, but then you won't have any jump height. So you want to have the best of both worlds. And the relationship between the power output, because that's what it is, the high jump with the shortest possible contact time, that means a high power output, was very well related to the maximum speed qualities. And for the endurance phase of the race, or the last part of the race, we found, of course, a very good relationship between the 16 seconds maximum counter movement jump, repeated counter movement jump. So during 15 seconds, you jump as high as you can for each jump, counter movement, okay. And then you see a decline in jump height and an increase in contact time, and of course, a decrease in power output, which is correlated to, say, electric endurance, the ATP and creatine phosphate metabolic systems.
Awesome.
So those are the four tests that we use, and those are the four tests which I found more best related to the different phases in sprinting.
Interesting. Okay, so Hank, you would say that the end of the race then is correlated pretty heavily with almost elastic endurance.
Yeah, I think so, because, I hated the expression elastic endurance, because then endurance is always related somehow to a loss of power output and to, what you call fatigue. But it's very hard to find something like elastic fatigue. It means like the fascia or the tendons, or they got fatigued somehow. So that leads to a decline in power output or to running speed. Because it could also be metabolic, we don't know. Because it happens so fast, in 3, 4, 5 seconds, you see a decrease in power output in jumping or in running. And we call it endurance, we call it fatigue, but we don't know really the main causes of that, because it happens so fast. It's very hard to do research in that inside the muscle, like biopsies. By the time you punch the muscle, and it's very hard to do it while running at full speed, all those processes are over again, because it happens within a tenth of seconds. But if you want to call it elastic and endurance, yes, why not? Why not? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a good answer. The tendons certainly don't get tired. connective tissue. Hank, second question I have for you is, how should coaches approach steering an athlete towards their own optimal sprint technique? I've heard you talk at length about this before in terms of coaches trying to apply or steer athletes towards what would be said to be the perfect technique, if that even exists. And how much cueing or coaching should even be done, in your opinion, for athletes as they progress through?
Well, as much as necessary and as little as possible, basically. Or as little as possible, as much as necessary, say it better. So, number one, not all things that you observe can be changed. Not all things that you can change should be changed, because it will take a long time before you change something, and not always for the better. So I say, if it ain't broken, I don't try to fix it in the first place. I know that some colleagues are very keen on, say, you had your toe in and big toe and little finger and everything. I'm just not like that, because people will run away for a certain reason, because anatomically they're built like it. And fixing things might lead to compensation, or fixing things might lead to just running slower. I tried, and some people just run slower. They felt comfortable running in a certain way. Second of all, the assumption is that there's a certain perfect technique. There's a model of technique that is okay, and it seems to be this model for everybody. And number one, I do not agree. There's no perfect running model for everybody. And number two, this all model doesn't really exist. If you look at well, just a nail and a hammer, and you hammer this nail, then even then you can see every movement there, every time you hit the nail in a different way. You can see it with your naked eye, but with a camera you can see. And it seems there's a different solution to the problem from going from A to B, from lifting the hammer to hitting the nail. It seems to be a different solution all the time for this problem. You can also see it in different stabilities of running. Then every stride should always be the same stride length and a stride figure. It's just not. Otherwise, long jump would be easier. Everybody would always hit the board. It's a very consistent movement because there's so many influences as well. I mean, the wind or the track surface or whatever feelings of fatigue. They have to be corrected. So there's not a very stable model of sprinting at high speed, and certainly not a model that will apply to every athlete just because of different anatomical and physiological and maybe even psychological or biochemical factors.
So how much cueing in the course of a standard practice session, how much cueing would you say you would do?
Not much, unless they kind of having serious biomechanical problems like leaning backwards or running sitting or running on the heels or arm swing is way too large or not lifting the knees or having the simple problems. Not much unless. And the second, I have to believe that by correcting things, they can run faster, and the time is the proof that they are running faster, as a matter of fact. So it's not to let them run the way they run. That might be very inefficient, but I know it's very hard to really correct a technique without screwing things up, because athletes also start thinking about technique, and there's one thing that slows you down is thinking about your technique. By the time you think about, oh, I should lift my knee, you're 10 meters down your lane already. I mean, you're 10 meters down. So the moment, one of my athletes once said, Hank, I don't think while running, because if you can think, you're running too slow. And I think he was absolutely right. When you can think, you are running too slow.
Yeah.
Because the feedback system is much faster. So when you kind of interfere with cognitive thoughts about, oh, my arm should be like this, then, well, yeah, absolutely, you're running slower.
Yeah. That leads me into my next question as well, and this is actually something that I learned from Jeff Moyer that you had mentioned in terms mm-hmm. of yeah. talking about the types of brains in athletes and right and left-brained athletes, or for those mm-hmm. in the audience who might not be familiar, quantitative athletes versus spatial athletes, and yeah. how would coaching those athletes differ in terms of using internal or external cues when you do cue the athlete?
It's very different because the brain is the ultimate performance organ of the human being. It's not the muscle, it's not the heart or the bone or the fascia, it's the brain. Where's motivation? Where's coordination? Where is coping with stress? Where is motor learning? Where is memory? Where is, movement? It all starts from the sensory motor cortex. So basically it's in the brain. Now, everybody has a different brain. So at the moment, it's way too complex, of course. It's the most complex organ in the cosmos. So there's no way of understanding it completely, but at least you'd have some profile that you can understand clustering athletes in groups of, for instance, left brain oriented or right brain oriented. No matter how old this concept is, there's still a lot of truth in that. And not everybody looks at the world or looks at the track or looks at sports or looks at life in the same way that you and I do. I mean, we all are different. It also helps to understand the athlete, his actions, his behavior. It also understands motor learning. While some people learn fast, other people learn slow. While some people are more acoustically oriented, other more visually oriented, other more kinesthetically oriented. People learn in different ways. So by understanding the brain, you understand much more about communication of athletes. So you understand why some corrections work in one athlete and don't hit home in the other athlete. That's what you learn from that. I think it's very important and neglected. We do a lot of work on muscles and testing muscles. We do a lot of work on everything apart from the brain, and that's what I find surprising.
So also speaking about the brain, and that was a great answer, Hank, because we definitely all train different types of athletes and cues don't work the same, I think, as us coaches have found out. Mm-hmm. So you've done testing on neurotransmitter types such as dopamine, acetylcholine, GABA, and serotonin. And I had read the Eric Braverman's book myself, so I was pleased to see that you had done some work with it. And I've had my own athletes take the survey, and you know, you hope that what is on the survey is correct, but you've actually gone, I believe, and done scans. And can you talk a little bit about your work with neurotransmitter types, what you're finding with the scans, and how that might lead coaches to train athletes?
Yeah, we didn't do the scans. We did the EEG, which is basically a scan as well, to see a more primitive way of brain functioning, because, well, every part of the brain works in a different way in a different time. So you meet two electrodes are not enough to understand the whole brain functioning of the whole brain. It just understands the part that's below the electrodes. Some might have 128 electrodes to understand what's happening. Number two, with the neurotransmitter types, there's not much you can change about it. It's probably genetically determined by enzymes that for the production and the breakdown of those neurotransmitters. So there's not much you can change. A little bit by lifestyle, by behavior, we always come back to the type that you are. Some people are, well, say dopamine dominant. There are people with a lot of drive, a lot of energy all the time. Well, if you lack of dopamine, well, you can correct it with drinking lots of coffee or snorting cocaine or taking amphetamines or something, but that's not a road you want to travel, as a matter of fact. And you can correct it with medication, but it mainly tells you how this athlete thinks and works. And Braverman describes it very well in the book, how those types are. So you start to understand about this athlete and find better ways of specifically approaching this athlete in all kinds of ways.
So I know Poliquin had made some basic training assumptions, things like saying dopamine athletes, I believe they needed like higher intensity and training less often and things like that. Have you found that there's training implications as well?
Little, as a matter of fact. And why? Because some athletes might be better off, if you look at neurotransmitters with different ways of training, you might say, well, this athlete is better off in doing more aerobic work. Absolutely, but that has little place in if you want to run under 10 seconds, then aerobic work and doing lots of aerobic work has little place in training. So as far as you can't escape the fact, the demands of competition, as a matter of fact, no matter what your brain type is. So this is the problem. You might be better off doing something slow, but something slow doesn't really help you to go faster.
Do you think that, and my next...
Sorry?
Oh, sorry. I was going to say my next question is on muscle fiber types. Before I get to that, do you think there's any link at all between like a dopamine type person and their fiber typing? I imagine it'd be completely separate, but the idea of the wired fast twitch athlete or anything like that?
No, I didn't find much relationship there. So basically you have a different type. You have, for instance, high dopamine with fast fiber, you have high dopamine with slow fiber. You have high dopamine with low dopamine with fast fibers, and low dopamine with slow or fast fiber. So, no, it's not related, as a matter of fact. And that explains why, for instance, you find different types in the 100 meters, and you also find different personalities and different types in the marathon running. You find very introverted people in the 100 meters, and you find very extroverted people in the 100 meters, which is probably more related to the brain types and to the neurotransmitter types. So it's not related to event, I found out, and it's not related to performance at all.
Okay.
But it just helps you to optimize the training for that athlete to enhance his natural tendencies or to compensate for natural tendencies, tendencies, as a matter of fact.
Okay, interesting. Thank you for clarifying that. That was great. Regarding muscle fiber types then and training, and this was kind of a paradigm shifter for me. I chatted with you at Jay DeMeo's conference and asked about, you know, like the idea of, oh, I have a really fast twitch athlete and shouldn't I improve their endurance to make them well-rounded? And you kind of set me straight on that one. So could you chat a little bit about muscle fiber types in training and how athletes who are fast twitch or slow twitch should approach training differently?
Well, it kind of approaches training automatically. So you don't know the fiber type of the athlete, and you make him run, I want to say 300 meters, and then it's a 200 meter type, you make him run 300 meters. If he starts in 38 and ends up in 41, you know, it's probably a fast type. If he starts at 38 and ends up at 36, it's probably a slow type sprinter. So you find that fast twitch sprinters always start off very, very fast and very, very well, very high speed. But they're lacking endurance, like the slower, more the slow fiber type. And so they have a strong decline in whatever they do within a repetition and let's say within the 300 meters and even within a series of 300 meters. So you see the time dropping from or increasing from 38 to 41. So they start fast and they end up slow. And they say the slow twitch fiber types, they have a different personality most of the time. And they start up a little bit cautious. They start up at 38 and say, ah, okay. And then number four, five, and then the last one, they squeeze out everything and they run at 36. So that's kind of normal. You can also find it in the jumping, as a matter of fact, 15 seconds jumping or even 30 seconds jumping. You see the slow fiber type starts jumping with, let me say, 30 centimeters and ends up in 25. Or the fast type starts with 45 centimeters and ends up in 20 centimeters. So the decline is much stronger. So in the last three jumps, it could be a slow type is jumping higher than the fast type because the fast type has lost all its energy and all its fuel already in the first 25 seconds. In the last 5 seconds, doesn't jump anymore. It's way too tired.
How many jumps or sprints would you do in those cases with the 300 or the jumps, Hank?
Yeah. Like, what kind of jump?
Oh, like you're talking about the 300. How many 300 or what would that or what are the specifics behind those tests? Like how many of those runs or jumps would you do in a row?
Oh, well, for the 300 meter running, it's 5 times 300 meters with the 5 minutes rest or 4 minutes rest. And for the jumping, it's 30 seconds. What 30 seconds? It's repetitive counter movement jumping for 30 seconds. And you can measure the decline in jumping height and the increase in contact time. So they can see from there, a long distance, or say a slow fiber type will go from here to there. So, okay, from this is the first jump and this is the last jump. And the sprinter will go from here to there. So this is the first jump and this is the last jump over here. So from that angle, you can see if people are fast or slow twitcher as well, how much they spend their energy because you're demanding maximum jumps all the time.
Yeah, makes sense. I fear I'm a little more slow twitch than I thought looking back on some of my college workouts.
Basically the fiber type is the most simple one because it's again not 100% determining if you can run slow or fast. Thank God there's other factors as well. There's a technical factor as well. You can have a car with a huge engine, but if the wheels are standing in this direction, you don't go anywhere, no matter how strong your engine is. So there's a technical factor as well, the efficiency of using that energy. But I found again it's a neglected factor. So I think there's a difference in your approach of coaching people who have 80% fast twitch fiber or 70 or 60% fast twitch fiber. The ability to handle larger workloads is better in the slow fiber type or in the one with the less fast fibers. And the ability to handle high intensity work, but also the time for recovery is larger in the ones with the fast fibers. They can handle very high intensity workloads, but low volume and they need more time for recovery. So basically that's it. It's as simple as that.
Awesome. Easy enough. Yeah. I think you have some anecdotes about like, in your own coaching days, coaching some really fast twitch athletes and trying to give them more speed endurance, but then their, or maybe that was someone else too, but then their first 60 wouldn't be very good or something like that. Could you give a little breakdown into the track and field, like some nuts and bolts?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. What we did was with a very fast type and do lots of focus more on speed endurance work, so the more type that's more suitable for slow fibers. And yes, the last part of the race, they improved 1 or 2 tenths of a second. But the first part of the race, the faster twitch type part, they lost 3-4 tenths of a second because, well, number one, we didn't have much time to spend there. And number two, the dominance of the slow fibers slowed down the contraction speed of the fast fibers. Not after one session, of course, but after a couple of months, it started to work out in a negative way.
Yeah, so you had mentioned, I think it was Jay DeMeo's seminar, how if your slow twitch fibers can actually keep your fast twitch from functioning optimally.
Yeah, Well, fast, if you have a lot of fast twitch fibers, of course that's a gift. You need more. You need the right say reactivity. You need the right technique and so on. But it's a gift that you should be well, use it carefully. As a matter of fact, especially the recovery is significant. That people need more time to recover from an intense workload or from a heavy workload. And the real sprinters are always called lazy. They're not lazy. They're just running so fast that they just draw, I call it a vortex in their fuel tank. Of course, they're running out of fuel so fast because they run so fast. You could run slower and not spend so much fuel. But that's not an option if you're a sprinter.
That's a great answer and great point there with the vortex. And okay. Circling back to building speed and plyometrics, how big of a role should bounding exercises play, and how much can or should an athlete expect to do those types of things before it starts cutting into their sprint technique?
Okay, I am. The truth is always somewhere in the middle. There's people who do lots and lots and lots of bounding. There's people who don't do any bounding because of risk of injury. I'm a little bit opportunistic in there, or opportunistic in most cases, and say, okay, if your athlete can handle, I have guys who are living kangaroos. They could jump over hurdles endlessly without Achilles tendon problems, without knee problems, without back problems. So yes, I love jumping for these kids. I also coached the athletes who couldn't jump at all. They had a more of a lordosis. The women had more lordosis. They had knee problems and ankle problems. So why would they make them do a lot of jumping? There's many safe jumps, or there's vibration training to increase explosive strength without the risk of injury. Because every exercise should be judged on the relationship between the effect, the training effect, and the risk of injury. Well, bounding is a very powerful tool, but it has also a high risk for injury, not in the short term. And you don't feel it, and you're not punished because you don't feel tired. Now, you're bounding over six hurdles. You're not breathing heavily because you're bounding over six, over 10 hurdles, over six hurdles. But the impact on the passive movement apparatus and the joints and the ligaments and the tendons, it's just tremendous, and that's going to backfire in the long term, not in the short term, but in the long term. So you have to be very careful with bounding. Although it's effective, the risk is there's a rather small optimum window of for very effective but high risk of injury. And then if you know that from your athlete, and your athlete can handle that, then you do more bounding. If they can't handle it, don't do it, because you are just injuring an athlete. And the injured athlete seldom wins a medal or seldom breaks a record, you know. They're on the table somewhere with the physio or the therapist or the surgeon.
Do you think that for those athletes that can handle it a lot, that like with the links between acceleration, like overbounding, like in acceleration, do you think that doing too much could show up negatively? Or if you can do it well, do you think it's something that can be done in a good volume?
That's a hard question. It's a hard question. Well, don't forget, why would you bound? People can bound, 30 meters, you know, just normal, regular bound. You can do it 5 times and you see effect. Why would you do it 10 times or 20 or 30? Why would you bound 100 meters? Just because you can? I won't. Again, do as much as necessary, not as much as possible. And it especially applies to bounding because of, when you do more than necessary, you just destroy the athlete. And I don't feel, well, you're a big country, right? So if you have 100 athletes, you can destroy 90 or 95, and the five that are left win the Olympic trials and go to Olympics and might win a medal. If in Holland we have one athlete, and if I destroy this athlete, nothing left. Next one won't make it to the Olympics, that's for sure. So you have to take very good care of athletes as a necessity, because we don't have many athletes to burn, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, awesome. Hank, one of my favorite articles of yours is where you talk about what happens when you apply too much sports science. I think it was the example of a speed skater who had, you know, everything, all the monitoring and every little detail was accounted for. And I know over here, at least, we have there's a little bit of an animosity, I think, between the strength coaches and then the sports science data people and back and forth. And what is an appropriate balance in your mind for coaches who are applying sports science and data measures in their training?
Well, sports science is not a panacea. It's not a miracle that helps every athlete or every coach to run faster. Of course, we need science, but science is more than the articles you read or the books, science is just a basis of knowledge. It could also come from experience, even if not scientific. For coaches, experience is as important as well. So compare the coaches to the artists. In Holland, we have the famous painter. When you come to Holland, you have to go to the Rijksmuseum and see the painting, The Night Watch, from Rembrandt. He's a famous Van Gogh. He's a famous painter. They didn't know anything about the chemical composition of their pigments or their paint. They didn't know the quality of their brushes, of the hairs of the brushes. They had no clue. But they made beautiful paintings. And now, even if you're a chemist and you know all the chemical composition of your paints and your pigments, it's not. But you give him the brush and the paint, and he won't paint the Night Watch or a Van Gogh painting. He won't do it. That's the difference between a coach and a scientist. So science is always geared towards averages. So we do drop jumping. We say, well, if we do drop jumping from 20 inches, it increases jumping power in average 2 inches. Hey, great. So you think, hey, 2 inches, that's good. But we're averaging it. There's people who might jump 4 inches in this group that they tested, and there's people who might decrease their jumping height or have no effect at all. So science always geared towards averaging, to generalizing, to well, I don't work with average athletes, and I don't want average performances. So science is good for average athletes and average performances. It's not good for genetic freaks. I found out the hard way. Everything that I learned based on tests and science done on average athletes, on sports students or untrained people or sedentary people, didn't apply to the genetic freaks that I was coaching. Of course not. Of course not. So they seem to defy all the rules and all the things that I learned from the books. And I started thinking, why is it possible? These people are smart people, smart scientists, do a lot of research, but on the wrong people. So how many Usain Bolts are there to do research on? Of course, it can never be a topic of research because there's one only. There's only one Usain Bolt. And just below him, there's only 4 or 5 people in the world. And that's not enough to make a statistic valid research. But then you're looking at exceptional people with exceptional qualities, and that's not where science is looking for. Science is always looking for the average person. And then science is dynamic. What? There's a kind of a expiry date on scientific knowledge as well. What was true 15 years ago is complete crap right now. And in the same way that things are true, and in 15 years we look back at the things that we know and we're laughing about it in many fields. That's the second one. And the third one about sports science is basically that well, it's not anymore sports where science was unbiased. There was some value-free science. Now just science for the sake of science. But it's not like this anymore. Science is as biased as anything else. It's dictated by the pressure to publish articles, no matter what quality. It's published by political pressure, by financial gains. So it's not just unbiased and value-free. It's also personal status, ego is involved in science as well. So not all science can be trusted for that matter. Nor can all coaching be trusted. Everything that coaches say be trusted as well. It's biased as well, of course. What I say is biased as well. Why? Because it's molded by my experiences with my athletes, in my environment, in my limited resources. It might be completely different for the people. So always keep that in mind. Always take it with a grain of salt, you know, what I say. So always keep it into the right perspective. Hey. Not saying science is bad. We need science. And of course, I use a lot of scientific knowledge, but then I try to apply it to my athlete, and that's the trick. How can I apply the knowledge from scientific research on this particular individual athlete that I see? And sometimes it works, and sometimes it just doesn't. And it's not the fault of my athlete, because it doesn't follow the rules that science dictates to me. It's just because science was done on the wrong athletes. So the things that I learned from that do not apply on my athlete.
Hank, you've talked a little bit about the warrior versus the worrier type athletes. Can you go into a little bit of detail on how you would approach training those two different types of athletes, and And in terms of either queuing or training loads or just going being about coaching them.
Well, the warrior, first of the warrior, is it's different personality, different character, different mindset to everything they approach. The one has a lot of adrenaline going on all the time and feels good with it. That's the warrior, as a matter of fact. I worry about a lot of things, but I'm doing pretty well. You know, I'm on top of my performance. I'm here. The moment I start to compete, I feel the pressure and I'm going down the drain. I'm beyond the optimum level of adrenaline because I feel great. I function perfectly in this level of adrenaline. In training, I do well. And when I go to a major competition, there's more adrenaline coming at the warming up. I start thinking about it and then I start to function suboptimally. The warrior is, as a matter of fact, is suboptimum adrenaline level. They always look bored and they're looking for excitement, they're looking for challenges all the time. Why? To get it all the way to the optimum level. And the competition does that. They go from suboptimal adrenaline levels to optimum adrenaline levels. So they do perfect. And that's the reason why they always peak on the right time. It's, you know, nothing to do with periodization or peaking in a physical sense. It has to do with their appraisal of is this competition a challenge or is it a threat? Well, the warrior starts to see it as a threat because he always feels really good in coaching and the training and everything is nice and comfortable. He feels in this comfort zone. When he's out of the comfort zone, he feels there's a threat. Well, the warrior feels this as a threat. So they always look for, always challenge you and you always challenge them and they like it because then they start to function better, more turn closer to optimum. And competition does that to them. That's the reason why they always peak at the right moment. So one enters the stadium, the one enters the stadium says, shit, you know, I feel the pressure. When you see them in the warming up, they can still do fantastic things. When they come into the stadium, you see a different person there. They seem to have shrunk a little bit. They come, oh yeah, well, you know, I might not belong in here. Look at them, okay. And 100,000 people are watching me right now, and the people on TV are watching me. They feel the pressure, and they crack on the pressure. But the warrior, they love the challenges. They look at a full stadium. They come to watch me, 100,000 people, you know. On the workout, nobody is watching. On the national championships, 10,000 people. They hear 100,000 people, and they all come to watch me. Oh, man, this is a great moment for me. So they welcome the stress, they welcome the pressure, as a matter of fact, because they know they can function optimally. And it's basically genetically determined, but there's a way to mold it as well. Maybe you cannot change the genes, but by epigenetics, you can by the right approach, and believe me, it's not easy. In my work, I always talk about the breaker, the bender, and the bloomer, or the blossomer, the one that blossoms under stress, the one that welcomes the stress. And the breaker, they always seem to crack under pressure, and that's because they squeeze out too much adrenaline. If you know that, you have to do a warming up, for instance, which is different. If people are very nervous on the warming up, and they, oh, Hank, yo, I forgot my spikes. Oh, well, okay. Okay, slow down, warm up slow. First, foot in, two laps, very slowly. Then stretch dynamically for 30 seconds, 1 minute, very slow. Well, the ones that is at a warming up, say, Hank, you know, I don't feel like competing. I don't feel any adrenaline. Everybody has yawning and okay. Another day in the office. Well, it's Olympic Games, a world championship. Okay, but here we go. Not jogging slow, but doing strides. Okay, come on, stride, palm. Walk back. Push-ups, 10 push-ups. Okay, stride again. Okay, come back. Squats. Okay, come back. Okay. And now stretch. Pump, pump, pump. More dynamic way of stretching to arouse the system, to bring more adrenaline into the system because you're still functioning as well, suboptimal or submaximal at the adrenaline levels. So you have to do different things. You have to do different talk to them. And sometimes when you coach a group of athletes, I mean, I'm not talking 20 athletes, but 5, 4, 5, 6, 8 athletes, you have to make that switch all the time as a coach. So if you're too excited and talking to an athlete who is already excited himself or overexcited himself, it just, okay, not good for this athlete. If the athlete is under aroused, has no adrenaline, you say, well, you know, okay. Then also for this athlete, it's not good. So you have to change your own approach to the warming up and to create the optimal level of arousal. That's probably the main thing in warming up. It's not the physical thing. It's mainly looking for the optimum level of arousal, the optimum level of adrenaline for that athlete, keeping in mind that inside the stadium it will increase again, apart from the warming up.
That's awesome. I like the idea of, a lot of people look at warm-ups just from the sense of, neuromuscular, but adrenaline being a huge factor. Very interesting. Last question I have for you, Hank, is can you talk a little bit about your new book, What We Need Is Speed, and what readers can look forward to with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, for many years, people ask me, you wrote many articles, you gave many talks, presentation lectures. Why don't you put it all together in a book? Well, writing a book is a drag. So I didn't feel like it. And all of a sudden, I kind of think, okay, yes, why not? I just start to write a book. It's not a scientific book, although the title says somewhere, it says some scientific approach to scientific practice of getting fast. Okay. Don't care about the scientific part. It's based on the work of the scientists I worked with in the past, European exercise physiologists, a biomechanist, or nutritionists. They were good scientists, but I had to mold their information again to get the best out of my athlete, not to all the athletes, the average athlete, to do that. So I decided to put at least some things on paper that I thought were interesting. First, a little bit of an overview. And it's the first of a series of books. I think I'm coming out with two or three more, but as a matter of fact, currently I'm writing in, to go more into detail about all the aspects of training sprinters. So first, a very simple overview. And then, there's some practical examples in there about training programs of athletes. But then also, some aspects I will go deep in, like I didn't go into injuries or recovery. I didn't go into the mental aspect. I didn't go into nutrition or something. So these things are important as well. But, there's so much to write, and I have only so much time available to write a book. That's it. But I hope people that buy it, well, it's not a textbook. It's not that, now I know everything about sprinting. For sure not. What you're missing still is experience. But at least I hope it will give you something to think about, at least. And you start, okay, I'm always giving lectures to sometimes 200 coaches, and I'm lecturing basically for the one guy who was like me, who thinks, okay, number one, I've heard this before. What he's saying, I've heard it before. That's good, because now there's the two of us. We can't be too far off. And there's always people that say, I don't know, this guy must be crazy, because I don't understand what he's saying. But there's also one guy in there in the audience that will say, shit, I have no clue what he's talking about. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to Wikipedia. I'm going to read his work. I'm going to do the website. I'm going to educate myself, because I want to know why he's doing this. So first, there's a little bit of resistance to what I say, what I think, and what I wrote or what I talk about. And then they kind of start finding out themselves and see there's more. So it's just a push into the right direction. It's not a cookbook. I can't teach you to coach or to create great sprinters. I wish you could do it for my book. You can see it, but there's quite a few books in here already. I didn't learn it from the books. I learned it the hard way, like everybody has to do. But I give you some direction about new ways of thinking and new ways of opening people's eyes, because most of the time our knowledge is limited. It's very hard to look outside of the box. If you don't read German, it's very hard to, or Russian, it's very hard to see what they did. And they sometimes there's interesting ideas coming from other countries. But the U.S. is such a big country, so the setback is you don't need to go beyond the U.S. to learn something, because there's all so much knowledge already there. Well, now then you see, of course, the influence of the Europeans as well, as far as the former East Bloc, the Russian secret, and the Russian this and the Russian that. No, that's also a little bit too much. There's no Russian secret, I can tell you. There were Russian secrets. We know that from the last Olympics, but that's not really a secret anymore. Everybody knows that. So it's more reality-based. It's based on the reality, the things I encountered, the things that I read in the books, and the things that I did on the track, and the things that worked. It's by trial and error. And I hope to kind of... decrease the time that you have to spend in trial and error, because I already made those mistakes. And the main message is, look at this is what I did. I made a mistake. Think about it. If you do the same thing, you can make a mistake as well. So try it, but don't try it for too long like I did. I only tried for a short time and I figure out if he did the right thing or not, if it was a mistake or not.
Also, it sounds like a great book, Hank. I'm totally looking forward to reading it, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to get a lot out of it there. Especially, I mean, you're listening to you talk at seminars is definitely one of the highlights for me, and I'm always looking to either learn where you all got it from or just more about it. So that's great. And it's been great having you on the show today. Really appreciate you taking the time, so thank you so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. And if any time in the future you want to do it again or some more, then just let me know. You know, I always make time for you and motivated colleagues to share a little bit of my knowledge. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome, man. I'll talk to you later. Thank you for tuning in with us today on the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Next week, we're going to have Curtis Taylor of the University of Oregon. So you get two awesome speed training weeks in a row. Curtis is one of the best in the game. I'm really excited to bring you the knowledge he has next week. Please visit our sponsors, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end training technology. They have made a huge difference in the way that I coach athletes in terms of being able to quantify important measures and data, and I couldn't imagine some of the speed training I've been doing without them. Last but not least, if you like the show, please leave a review, or even if you don't. we're trying to get the word out there of what we're doing here on Just Fly Sports, trying to bring coaches and athletes some of the best practical sprint and jump, vertical, power, et cetera, training. And it would really help us out. We'd appreciate it. And we'll see you guys next week.